Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the 29th episode of Why Aren't People Into That? The podcast that makes eye contact, glances at your crotch, makes eye contact again, back to the crotch, raises its eyebrows, and nods almost imperceptibly towards the nearest dark alley. I'm your host, Tina Horn, and I am frankly beside myself to introduce comedian Kevin Allison, who I've admired for a long time, to the show today. Before I do, I just want to say thank you to everyone who has sent me love following the raid on the rentboy.com offices on August 25th. I am devastated, but free. In a way, two jobs were taken from me that day because I can't really give you my journalistic hot take on the situation. In fact, I shouldn't really be talking to you about it at all. Luckily, my community is fucking righteous, and you can read many of their hot takes on my blog at whyarepeopleintothat.com. Please remember that sex worker rights are human rights, and to quote Justin Vivian Bond, sex workers in our culture need to be protected, respected, and applauded, not harassed and shamed. Speaking of my community, Smitten Kitten continues to support this podcast, and I couldn't be more proud to direct you to smittenkittenonline.com for all of your sex toy and sex resource needs. When you're headed to checkout with a digital armful of erotica and leather restraints, enter the word Y, that's W-H-Y, to get 20% off your order. One excellent way to support sex worker rights is to buy the books we write about our real-life experiences instead of letting white Hollywood actresses tell you about shit they don't fucking understand. One such book is my book, Love Not Given Lightly, which has just been out for a few months and is about me, but also about a bunch of other sex workers, including people who used to advertise on rentboy.com and now cannot. All right. So pick out your hanky and head down to the docks for Why Are People Into Cruising?
Hi, Kevin Allison.
Hello.
I'm so stoked to have you on the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Thank you for, I feel this weird like power imbalance because it's your setup. I'm very used to being like, well, here's my recorder. And now I'm like taking your voice into my little device, but now you could like hold this hostage and...
Oh, that's true. Yeah, no, you know, I've done that before. I've been on podcasts before where someone else was recording me. I did Mark Maron's once. And he accidentally destroyed the file right in front of me.
Asshole.
Oh, God. But, you know, it turned out to be a great thing because he had me back like a year and a half later. Mm. And we did more or less the same interview.
Yeah.
Except now he was comfortable with all the kinky stuff.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I listened to that show.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I really love it. I enjoyed. He's such a good sport, you know. Like you were making him squirm, but he I really appreciate how open-minded he is, actually, like, yeah. even about things that make him uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, and I think that's part of, like, yours and my job, mm-hmm. you know, is to invite people in a friendly way toward those, you know, yeah. frontiers.
Yeah. Put a friendly face on things that have scared people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you put a friendly face on things that scare people for a living. You're a comedian. You're on a show that I watched religiously when it was on MTV, The State. And then over the past decade and a half or so, you've been doing a lot of comedy and a lot of storytelling, and you mm-hmm. have your own podcast, The Risk Podcast, which mm-hmm. I'm sure most of my listeners listen to as well. and you also do, like, storytelling workshops, and you just started doing a like an online workshop, right?
Yeah, I have so Risk is my main company. We do live shows all over the place, and there's the podcast, but then I created something called The Story Studio. And so it's all storytelling workshops for either business people or people who want to perform on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And we've just created an online class that you can kind of take in your own time at your own pace.
Or no matter where you are in the
right,
world, right?
Right, that's exactly. really cool. It's called Intro to Storytelling. Wow, your crowd. There's a baby dying in the room next door.
Did you hire that baby to scream right at that perfect moment?
For our soundtrack. And it's all at thestorystudio.org.
Cool. And Risk is, what's the website for Risk?
Risk is at risk-show.com.
Cool. And that's been going on since 2009?
Yes. Risk is about 6 years old now, and it's a little bit like The Moth. It's a storytelling show, but the whole idea is that nothing is off bounds. Like, people can tell hilarious stories. Sometimes they're absolutely shocking and horrifying. Sometimes they're very profoundly moving. But it's stuff that they couldn't play on NPR because it's so raw and real. So, people love the way that Risk kind of goes anywhere.
I definitely love that about it.
Yeah.
And I can definitely remember, probably actually on WTF, but also on your show, hearing you talking about how much, maybe even just back in the day, you loved cruising.
Oh my God, yes. when I first came to New York, because when I was a kid, I knew I was gay, like, from the beginning of consciousness, you know, like, when I was, I always joke that my first thought I remember having was, I like boys' butts, and that's been every other thought that I've had since that afternoon, but I was pursuing the boy next door when we were both still in diapers, and I've been told about it by his mother. So I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is very Republican.
Yeah.
A lot of Republican money is in Cincinnati, very segregated, and very, very devoutly Catholic. Mm. I was raised. So
that's not a formula for repression
at all. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Now, my parents were politically liberal, politically, like, my father marched in the civil rights movement and everything like that.
Cool.
But when it came to sex, they were definitely from the 1950s. My mom was very... I remember when I was 12, I was wondering, when can I finally... 12 is such a funny age to be thinking finally, but I was like, when can I finally come out to my mom? And that same day, Marvin Gaye was on the radio singing Sexual Healing, because it was 1982. And she walked in and she said, when this song comes on the radio goes off.
Oh no!
And I was like, it's not gonna be anytime soon.
Marvin Gaye!
So when I came to New York, when I was 18, in 1988, and I was going to NYU. Mm-hmm. I came out of the closet to my parents 1 month before going to NYU because I planned it. I was like, look, it's going to take so much work to get all the scholarships and student loans arranged that they're not going to want to pull the plug.
Yes. That's brilliant.
So I came out and they were like, okay. And it was funny because I literally came out by using, I wrote it on index cards, a coming out speech. And I did not take my eyes off the card the whole time I was reading it to them.
Oh,
and
God.
The end of it was questions you might have and answers. So it was, you know, quite frequent, like almost like frequently asked questions. And the last one was, here's the name of a psychiatrist in case you guys need help with this.
Very thorough. Loving. That's very conscientious, right?
Right. And my dad was just like, oh my God, that is so amazing that you're like not suggesting we send you to a psychiatrist. You're suggesting we go see one if we have a problem.
Oh my God.
So, you know, when I went to NYU, I was a horny little guy. And my very first week in New York, I overheard some guys in the musical theater wing of the Tisch School of the Arts.
Yeah.
I wasn't there for musical theater. I was there for film, but I just happened to be hanging out in that hallway that day, and I heard these two guys saying, oh, there's this bar where all the guys from Columbia University go up at West 82nd Street.
Yeah.
And I always joke that, like, okay, in my first week, I clearly wasn't that clever because I'm right in the middle of Greenwich Village, and I'm like, oh, I guess gay guys gather.
You're like, 82. I'll go uptown. Makes total sense.
So I went uptown, and I went to this bar. It was called The Works, and paid $5, and they give you a little bracelet, and you can drink all the Pabst Blue Ribbon you want. But what I hadn't anticipated was that there was all this competitive energy in the room, right? Because I had grown up terrified of straight guys and their competitive energy.
Right.
Around
manifesting
things.
Manifesting sports.
Yes, yeah. Especially sports, even Monopoly and stuff like
sure.
that.
And also dating.
Yeah. Just you were right. Yeah, competing with one another, like, oh, I did this with this girl.
Right,
and
right. Which right. you weren't participating in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So to walk into a room for the first time where there's all these men kind of staring at each other in a way like, oh, you're mine, or oh, get away from him, he's mine, was frightening to me.
Was it exciting? Was it a turn off?
It was scary to me because I was like, holy shit, a lot of gay guys are really good looking. You know what I mean? A lot of these guys are really well put together. I was, you know, there was an article in New York Magazine once that said Kevin Allison was born with the queer but not the eye. So none of that sense of style or anything. So, yeah, no, I was intimidated. I was just like,
New York is just like that.
Yeah, New York. Exactly. Yeah. New York is very much like that.
But also,
that.
You had never probably been in a space where you could pretty much be guaranteed that every man that you were looking at was gay.
Yes.
And so it was just a matter of, okay, so which one of them do I find attractive? And then from there, which one would find me attractive? And can I make it work? You'd never, you know, you're 18, 19 years old, never had that experience, right?
Exactly. And you know what it was? It was the way what I realized later, because where that night took me, it was the way the place was lit, you know, that here was this place which was pretty brightly lit, and people were putting on such a good face, you know. Also, it was incredibly white and collegiate, and I had not yet started to put together that I'm naturally drawn to people of color, right? I was just so new to everything. So basically what happened was I kept saying to myself, oh, I'll talk to that guy, oh, I'll talk to that guy, and then just not getting up the nerve to do it until I was so drunk that I had to leave. I had to escape this bar. I was kind of like a bear on a unicycle, kind of tottering out
there.
Were
you by yourself? Did you have to?
Oh, I was by myself. Yeah. I was by myself. And at this point, it's probably about 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And I'm 18 years old. It's, you know, my first week at NYU. And I'm like, okay, that was a failure. That was okay. You know, it's my first time in a gay bar. Right, exactly. So let's just sober up and get the subway home. But then I looked across the street and I saw this big blank space where, as a new Yorker, I was like, wait a minute. When you look across the street anywhere, there's buildings. What's that blank space? And I was like, oh my God, that must be Central Park. I was that new to New York. I had no idea like how big Central Park was or where it was.
Yeah.
And indeed, it was Central Park.
Yeah.
And I was like, haven't I heard rumors that gay men congregate there in the park and have anonymous sex? Of course they do, but that happens at a very... I mean, it's a huge,
it's huge
park.
It's really big. It's really big. So maybe at, like, 86, like, Central Park West, maybe not. You're like, wandering around by, like, Alice in Wonderland statue, and you're like, is that... Where are they?
Oh, shit.
Where is everybody?
So what I decided was, I went into the park. You know, this is... What's so fun about being young, and I think that now that I've just started sobering up and, you know, yeah, and getting healthy, eating healthy food and all that kind of thing.
Raw vegan pizza.
Right. So much of my stories are about these young adventures, you know? And I think now that I'm 45, I'm looking at, well, how can I continue having young adventures but not being so stupid as to be, like, for example, walking into Central Park at 4 o'clock in the morning?
Oh, yeah, but that's the time to do it, because otherwise you're going to look back and be like,
oh, exactly.
What would have happened if I'd walked into the second largest, is it the largest park in
probably
in America?
I have no, no, it's probably not the largest. I think that might even be Prospect Park.
Is Prospect Park bigger than Central Park?
I think it might be.
Do people cruise in Prospect Park? They must.
I think they must, too. Yeah. Yeah. You know, there should be an app for all the cruising spots. It, you know, it should be like Happy Cow for vegans.
Well,
like, where do people cruise around
here? I mean, I was going to say, though, I mean, it is funny that in the late 80s that you would not leave the bar and just whip out your phone and start looking at Grindr and finding people in, even in Central Park, who are on Grindr, like, cruising around. Anyway, we can talk about how Grindr and Scruff and things have changed cruising, but you went into the park that night.
I went to the park and I said, look, I don't know where gay men do congregate. It's called the Ramble, but I didn't know that at the time and I didn't know where it was. But I said, look, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. It's dangerous to be in the park. Everyone knows that. So if a man is walking through the park, he's probably either on his way to a forest sex party or from one, so I'll just hook up with him. So I just hid in the bushes and thought that I would kind of shake the leaves if a guy walked past. And sure enough,
oh my God.
Sure enough, in about 10 minutes of sitting there, a guy comes down the walkway. It's kind of like foggy, like in a London, in a Charles Dickens movie or something. And he's dressed really nice with a briefcase. So I'm like, I don't know. Is he wearing Brooks Brothers or something? He looks not like he's going to a forest sex party, but let's give it a shot.
Yeah, you never know.
So I start, you know, just rustling around a little to let him know I'm there. He stops. He takes a good look like, is that a dude in the bushes? And you would think that he would say, yes, that is a dude in the bushes. Okay, I'm getting out of here. He's crazy. No.
No.
He was like, that is a dude in the bushes. It might be time to get our dicks out. And so sure enough, I blew this guy right there.
Wow. Wait, can you be more specific about, like, did you make eye contact? Did you say something?
Yes.
Did you gesture? Like, because that's the important thing that... If you do have experience cruising a lot, gay men have more experience with it and more opportunity to, like, learn all of these signals than, I think, a lot of other people. But, you know, even, that's the part that always gets skipped over in the story, so I want you to be more specific.
Right.
It's like, and then all of a sudden, I was giving him a blowjob. It's like, wait, how did that part happen?
You know, it's so funny because...
And that part is so hot.
Oh, yeah. It's It's now, you know.
Even if the blowjob is mediocre, the like excitement of realizing like, yes, this is happening right now in this park.
Because what it is that you're a little bit like animals in the wild, right? You see each other. And you're trying... Oh,
hi!
Here's my cat, speaking of animals in the wild.
Are you cruising us?
You see each other, and there's a little bit of fear in both of your eyes.
So
as
exciting.
Well as a little bit of attraction, because you don't know if this might be a gay basher, for example. Or just someone who would have zero interest in you that you're about to approach, and they would be like, what the fuck are you doing? You know?
Which could be embarrassing.
Right. So there's a matter of kind of lingering on each other's eyes and kind of creeping closer to each other, which was exactly what myself and this guy did. He was a good-looking businessman, probably in his 30s, and looked like kind of a no-nonsense guy. But he's looking at me and seeing that I'm just kind of hanging out there not saying anything and kind of looking at him. And just the look, it's almost indefinable. There's something in the eyes where you're like, oh, we're both wondering if the other might want to do something. And after it's lasted long enough and one hasn't simply turned away, then it's kind of, well, who's going to serve who or that sort of thing.
Right.
And I think that because I was 18 and felt like, I don't know, I just think I felt naturally in a submissive position right there, that I should initiate, like, getting down on my knees because, this guy seemed like a New Yorker and I was just a kid in school, you know what I mean?
I'm sure it was really, really a huge sacrifice for you to get that dick in your mouth. Wait, was that the first time that you had sex with a man?
No. I had done stuff in high school with, you know, that with the weird shit where it's like, oh, we were so drunk last night, you know?
Totally. That's its own, that's hot in its own way, but.
Right.
But yeah, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
So you blew him, and then he just kind of, like, put himself together and walked away?
Yes, and I was still so drunk, you know. Like, it took a lot of... The one thing that's a little... The reason that some of these details about, you know, the looks in eyes and things like that might be a little hazy is because, you know, back then I would get so drunk just to deal, with being
totally.
So new to being gay and all that kind of thing. And social anxiety, you know, I think that a lot of straight kids, when they're in junior high, start to get to work with, oh, how attractive am I? Oh, what are people doing to attract the gender they're after, et cetera, et cetera.
Totally.
Whereas I felt like I was, you know, just starting while in college, you know. So I was... very, you know, insecure about being in the realm of other gay men. Insecure with the male gaze and at the same time totally fascinated by it. And, you know, it is interesting that we mentioned that fear thing because there have been times that I've been at a gay bar that was, you know, very poorly lit or whatever and where it had a very cruisy atmosphere. And I would catch myself in the mirror. I even cruised myself once by accident.
Oh my God! That's fucking funny.
Yeah. It was at a place called...
You're like, that guy's looking right at me. Piercing blue eyes.
But one of the things that I always notice is that there's a little bit of fear in the eyes.
Yeah.
Kind of like a deer caught in the headlights.
Right.
Like, oh, you might shoot me or you might hug me. You know what I mean? Right.
Yeah.
So what then happened was... A friend, I fell into, you know, skip a few months, basically.
Sure. How did you feel? Did you go home like, fuck yeah?
Oh, no, it was so funny because I laid down in the bushes to rest a while and then fell asleep.
Oh, my God.
And when I woke up, someone had taken my sneakers.
Oh, my God. I can't... You can't leave that part of the story out.
Yeah,
that's fucking hilarious.
No, I think a homeless person must have found my sneakers and made away with them. So it's about 5 o'clock in the morning. I run down to the subway.
Yeah.
And the train is coming, and I'm like, oh my God, I've got to get on this train because the next one might not come for an hour, considering how early in the morning it is.
Yeah.
So as the train is whirring to a stop, all of a sudden I realize, oh my God, here's that nausea from all the drunkenness again.
Yeah.
The door goes boom, boom, and opens up, and I exploded with vomit into the car.
Oh my God, you were that guy.
I was that guy.
Barefoot.
Barefoot.
Oh.
Then I jumped in and slipped on it and fell on my ass.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
There were like 6 people on that car, and I just waved at them like,
oh,
hello, it's me. So that was a complete
mess. So you felt great is what you're trying to
say. Right.
Very satisfied.
When I first told that story on Risk, I did make it so that the guy did run away and we didn't have that blowjob because I thought, well, this is a story of failure. You know, it's like it gets messier and messier and messier, and it's fun to show me failing. But also, I wasn't sure how much we could actually say on Risk yet. You know, I wasn't sure how much the audience could really take. So now I tell it like I originally did, and then end it by saying, by the way, that was one of the first stories I've ever shared on Risk, and there's a lie right in the middle of it, because I blew that guy, and then it brings the house down.
Oh my God. Oh my God, that is amazing.
So
how did it become a hobby?
I started getting into the gay club at NYU, but it was very sterile feeling. The gay club, gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans club that there was at that time around 1988-89 at NYU, there just wasn't much happening, so I started my own. I started my own called Out Artists at the Tisch School of the Arts. And that's how I made my posse of friends. All, you know, young, you know, people who were going to Tisch or just people who loved the arts. And so we were a much more fun group of friends than I found at the main LGBT group at NYU. And one night, my friend Derek said to me, because do you remember the Limelight? The Limelight was a club in New York in the 90s.
Okay.
That had been a church, that was an old Gothic, like maybe Episcopalian church.
Where was it?
It's still there, and now it's, of course, it's like a high-end retail store.
Okay.
But it's, of course, the exterior still looks like a big old church. But in the 90s, it was a dance club, and Thursday nights was gay night there. And Derek, my friend, tells me, hey, what a lot of people don't know, even gay guys who go to the Limelight don't know, that there's a secret passageway close to the entrance into the dance realm, where if you go through that door, it looks like you're all of a sudden going to be like, you know, lost in a closet. But you can walk up the spiral staircase, the steeple of the church. It's kind of rickety, like in Vertigo, right?
Oh,
it's kind of like, oh my, am I going to fall through one of these steps? But at the top is where they used to keep the bell in the bell tower.
Oh my God.
And dudes have sex up there. And I was like, oh my God, I have got to get up into that bell tower.
Amazing.
So, because I have never had, another way I'm a totally bad gay is, I've never had any interest in dancing. So I used to go to the Limelight just to go up into the bell tower.
Oh my God. You're like, I'm going getting straight to business here.
So the first time I went in there, it was so exciting because It was very dark. The only light was like the moonlight coming in from, you know, whatever the windows.
Yeah. Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah. It was kind of like atmospheric that way. And it had this real smell of like men's sweat and cum. And lube. Like, you could smell a lot of, I don't know, whatever the fresh smell of lube was in there. So the, all that kind of that concoction, I guess they also might call it Santorum.
Right. Santorum smell. Santorum smell.
Well, it was kind of intoxicating to me. And there was this young man there who... You know how it is when you're in the dark. When you're in the dark, it's like, in my mind, it was River Phoenix. You know, I was like, oh my God, this kid looks like River. It was just this blonde kid. And he was preoccupied with someone in front of him. Someone was giving him a blowjob or something like that. And I was like, I wonder if he'd mind if I just went down below and get and... You know, gave him a
chances
rim job
are
from behind. So
services.
Yes, I did. And see, I have all, like, rimming is like my giantest obsession. It's just my favorite thing in the world.
Yeah.
Love it. And that was my first time. My first time rimming someone was this River Phoenix boy. And I don't know. It's just one of those things that makes me happy just to remember it.
It's a very sweet story.
Yeah, because what happened was I went down, I pulled his cheeks apart and started licking at him, and he looked back around like, what's going on behind me? As if, you know, he might be thinking for a moment, should I shoo this person away?
Right.
But then he saw my face look up at him and he was like, yeah, I like this dude eating my ass. So I was in heaven. And... What I soon learned is that is the way it works in the male-to-male realm of cruising in anonymous sex places. If you don't like someone, you can pretty aggressively shove them out of the way.
Yeah.
You can just wipe their hand out of the way rather brusquely.
Yeah.
And if they keep pursuing you, you can kind of hit their hand out of the way, you
yeah.
know, to say, no, you should have understood me the first time. Just
yeah.
get away from me. And if it never gets to that, if it never gets to physical contact, you can just nod like, no, not you. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was very interesting to be in this realm where rejection was that quick. And simple, right?
And then after a while, you probably just kind of get used to it's like not that big a deal. Like,
exactly.
Oh, not you? Oh, well, on to this other guy.
Exactly.
Right. Probably good for building confidence if you like really start throwing yourself into it.
You know, it's really interesting because to me, I always have historically looked back on it as that it became a little bit too much of a crutch.
Yeah.
Because then what happened was... What happened that very first night at the works
yeah.
became the pattern of my life. By the time that I was out of college and a young gay guy, on TV even,
yeah.
my friends would joke, Kevin will be here for one or two drinks, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and then he's going for some anonymous sex. We're not going to see Kevin very much this night
yeah.
because he's going to end up in the dark room or just heading straight to a sex club. And that's not that's what that's called is social anxiety. It's that I didn't want to be having conversations with people because that made me so scared, whereas in the realm of cruising, if someone didn't like me, it was over in a flash of a second and there was someone else to focus on
right
next to them, you know? So yeah, it became a little bit of a crutch. And you know, there's another story I tell about going to the Bijou. The Bijou was a place across the street from the Boiler Room. The Boiler Room is still there, and I think the Bijou is too, but it used to be the Rolling Stones owned this underground space. Supposedly they owned it mostly for just doing heroin when they were in town.
I mean, you know, they needed a spot for that.
But apparently there was often rock and roll kinds of parties that would happen down there. And then
sounds hella fun.
Yeah. And then when the Stones sold the place, I guess, it became a gay club Which by the time I got there in 19, you know, in the late, around 1989 or so, it was known as the Bijou because they showed movies, you know, like, yeah, like a good, like a fancy French movie theater as if it's anything like that. But it was one of those sex clubs that has tons and tons of tiny little closet sized rooms because there were laws, and I think they're still in effect, that a place that charges a public for a public ticket,
right,
people shouldn't be having sex out in the open. There's plenty of semi-private sex parties that happen that, of course, right, do that. And that's always more fun, if you ask me.
Totally.
But a lot of the gay clubs in that roundabout the Giuliani era dealt with it by having tons of little closet-sized rooms. And I remember the night I discovered the Bijou, I was at the Boiler Room with my friends across the street.
Is that in Chelsea?
You know, the Boiler Room is East 4th, off of 2nd Avenue.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And when a friend told me about the Bijou, again, I literally said to him, oh, well, that sounds so much more convenient than standing over here having conversations.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just such a terrible attitude. But, yeah, that I went home that night, that first night that I went to the Bijou with a guy who made me tie my shoes to my balls, which at the time I knew nothing at all about kink, BDSM, pain, any of that. So it was just pure crazy to me. I was like, what? Especially because he didn't have a game plan afterwards. He was on coke and just wanted to masturbate in the corner of the room while he watched me stand there with shoes tied to my balls, which now I do for fun. You know, I'm like, that actually, that is kind of fun. You know, I've tied Doc Martens to my balls nowadays.
Yes. That's a sign.
Growth. But let's see. You know, over the years, what was fascinating to me, what was really exciting, was how I could sometimes bring that anonymous cruising thing into just the regular world.
Tell me more about that. That's really interesting.
One of the most exciting ever was I was a cater waiter. So I was probably about when I was 27 or so.
Yeah.
And I was dressed in a tuxedo, but I happened to have a fresh bottle of poppers in my tuxedo pants.
Never leave home without them.
Because I had planned on maybe going out after work. But then I decided, no, it's too late. I should go home. So I'm waiting, I think, for an F train or something like that at the 14th Street subway, round about the Union Square Street subway. And there's this Italian guy, very kind of like Rocky kind of guy, you know, like
Italian stallion.
Yeah, exactly. Very kind of like beefy in a fit way, with a kind of like Saturday Night Fever vibe about him. But he's in a jumpsuit. He's a transit worker, right? He's in like a greased up jumpsuit. For, you know, because he's been working with wrenches down in the subway.
That's not hot at all.
Oh my God. So the two of us, I'm just waiting for the train.
And you're in a white tuxedo?
No, I'm in a black tuxedo. Okay. Right. So I'm in a tuxedo. He's all greased up in a,
yeah.
And I noticed that we're both looking at each other. And at first I don't give it a second thought because I'm like, it's just not in my brain.
Yeah,
that
you're
someone
tired.
Like,
yeah.
And the way he's dressed and everything just reads straight to me. But then I realize, oh no, there's this thing in the eyes. There's this thing happening between us. And so I can let it linger. I let my eyes linger on him, and we are both definitely checking each other out. And it's scary because he might bash me, but he's hot. And so all of a sudden he makes a quick move with his head, like, come over this way. And I was like, okay. Again, this was like 3 o'clock in the morning, so there weren't people around.
Yeah.
And he's got keys to go into this little, like, fenced-in area that's, like, very dark.
Oh my God.
Where they keep, like, I don't know, extra tools or whatever to work down in the tracks.
Right.
And so he lets us in. Anyone still could have totally seen us.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just that no one would think to look over there. You know what I mean?
Right,
in the
right.
shadows. So, again, he unzips. He lets out his cock. It was a big, fat cock.
Ah!
Uncircumcised and everything. And I remember is I was like, because you usually don't have conversation, and that's the part that rubs me the wrong way a little bit, because I just tend to be such a conversing kind of person.
Right.
And I want something to go off
of. Isn't that so interesting, because you are sort of running away from the intimacy and vulnerability of conversation, but then also kind of feeling like that was lacking. That was what you maybe were after.
It's so true. It's so funny how we have these, like these magnetic pulls in us.
Yeah.
You do put me in a cruising situation, and all of a sudden, I'm the one who's being a little bit not playing by the rules.
Right.
There was one time. I'll get back.
No. Oh, okay. Okay. So okay, the guy. Yeah, so he pulls out his big Italian cock. I'm not going to let you leave me hanging. Okay.
So I did ask him, I was like, where are you from? Because the main reason I wanted to converse with guys like that is, if this seems really hot, let's see if we can make it happen again.
Right.
You know? I mean, I think that for a lot of guys, the realm of cruising is an area in the unconscious, you know? But I had a therapist once who said, oh, when you go into these cruising sort of situations, there might as well be a sign above the door where you're leading that says, abandon hope, all ye who enter here.
Oh, please.
And I was like, that sounds pretty moralistic. I was like, what do you mean? And she's like, well, okay, let's put it in a less moralistic way. Let's say you're going into the shadow world. And I was like, yeah, where the rules don't really apply. And so for a lot of guys, they don't want to say where they're from or what their name is or anything
right,
because they don't want there to be any kind of record of this. They want this to be maybe something that maybe they'll half or half not even remember themselves later, you know?
It's interesting. It seems like, I mean, your therapist being judgmental about it and, like, comparing it to hell is interesting, because obviously for a lot of people there's a lot of shame. Obviously a lot of people cruise because they're closeted,
yeah.
Which might be really hot to hook up. You know, who knows if this Italian stallion guy in the subway was, like, you know, straight in his normal life and then, you know, takes advantage of this access that he has to cruise. Like, who knows? Or maybe you found out, I don't know, but there's obviously lots of people like that, and that can be, I mean, that's its own genre of porn, right?
Yeah,
the straight guy who is, you know, either by coercion or curiosity or whatever. So, like, sometimes there is shame and repression that leads people to pursue cruising and having sex in that way, no strings attached, anonymous sex. But also, obviously, there's its own appeal that doesn't necessarily have to be about that. There's its own, the excitement of the danger, the excitement of not having to think about, you know, yes, maybe avoiding intimacy, but also avoiding, like, maybe stuff that you don't really want or that you're not offering, like, like emotional availability, right? And then you can just, the two people who just want sex and excitement can come together and have that and not have any pretense of something else.
Right, that this moment is just allowed to be purely
right.
sexual. Truly no strings attached. So I did. I said, where are you from?
Yeah.
And I'll never forget, he said, I'm from Canarsie.
Of course.
So, and that's the extent of our conversation, that he was from Canarsie. Because when he did say, I'm from Canarsie, it occurred to me, I was just like, oh, we're not gonna exchange numbers. Yeah. We're from two. He really is like Rocky. We are from two different worlds.
Yeah. Let me ask you. When, because a lot of the guys that you've talked about, like, the guy that looks like Sylvester Stallone, the guy that looks like River Phoenix, the, like, sexy businessman.
Interesting.
Like, it seems like all of these people were attractive to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then in some places were probably better lit than others, and beer goggles, like, more than others,
yeah.
Right? But I'm curious how important it is to you, and maybe also do you get a sense how important it is to other people that the person that you're cruising, that you actually find them physically attractive, like that they're your type, or are you just like looking for a willing hole?
Well, you know what happened is one of the things that's really fascinating to me about being a kinkster is you can go down rabbit holes. You know, you can open up Pandora's boxes and be like, how did I get here? How did I end up so obsessed with this, that, or the other?
Yeah.
So I started at a certain point, I had enough money from television and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Where I was like, I'll just go to the West Side Club, which was the most expensive of the gay clubs, cruising clubs.
Mm.
So this place like had saunas and it had all the closet sized rooms, but the closet sized rooms had beds and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Marble staircases, yeah. Somebody like waiting with like to spray your lube.
So for years I went there. I found myself at a certain point in my life where I was like, look, if I am such a horny bastard, if I am the kind of guy who loves to have lots and lots of sex, I should probably find a partner amongst the people who like to have lots and lots of sex.
That's the dream.
Right.
Yeah.
So why not strike up conversations with people at the West Side Club? I mean, some people, especially the guys on drugs, are there like all day.
And they're ready to talk, I'm sure, if they're on designer drugs and like early 90s. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think that aftercare, going back to aftercare, you know, you weren't necessarily doing anything like sadomasochistic or like dominant and submissive per se, but like all kinds of sex can really use good. I mean, making out can use some good aftercare.
It's
and
true.
Also, like, it to a certain degree, anonymous sex is its own in kind of intensity that you need to be brought back from, for the reason that we were also just talking about, that you are kind of going into this like other realm where the rules, the normal rules of society don't apply.
Yeah.
And being able to find people who can like bring you back and
right.
like acclimate you,
right.
you know, and kind of like bring you down from that, you know, kind of like psychedelic
yeah.
kind of state that you can get into.
I remember leaving the West Side Club, and this was about the time that I was in therapy with
yeah.
that woman that I mentioned earlier. I would make a point of turning on a tape recorder and saying how I felt just after leaving the club because it was so surreal to
yeah.
walk right back out into the sunshine or into the night or whatever and just see the rest of the world operating and feel like, wow, I was just, I just kind of was just spat out of a place where
yeah.
the vibe was so incredibly different.
And men are probably mostly socialized to think that they wouldn't need to have that kind of care, that they
right.
should just be able to have the sex, get off, and then like go get a slice of pizza.
Yeah,
right.
That's why at places like the West Side Club, there was always someone from GMHC with a table full of condoms and literature, who was like making a point of saying, "Hi, how you doing?" to everyone coming in and leaving.
That's awesome.
To be like, you know, I am someone who you can communicate with, you know?
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Especially during that time, I'm sure.
Yeah.
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 I'm curious if you think that it's possible for, you mentioned like finding one person to like have all of the hot sex with instead of having all the hot sex with all the different people.
Yeah.
I wonder.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I wonder if you think it's possible to create the kind of excitement of anonymous sex or cruising with someone that you know and trust. Like, can you, for example, negotiate a cruising scene with someone and enter into it both consensually and find that same excitement and rush of danger and rush of, like, going into this other realm that you can when the stakes are more literal?
I would absolutely love to find a situation like that. I mean, and I know that, you know, a lot of the people that I admire so much, people like Reed Mihalko and Allison Moon, Melina Williams, a lot of my friends in the kink community, are very playful people.
Yeah.
Are people who are very game to, well, what the heck, let's try this on for size tonight.
Yeah. They've all been on this podcast.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that they're also all partnered, you know, like
right.
You know, Melina said to me a long time ago that she realized that as a kinkster and as someone who was publicly known to be a kinkster and was kind of making a career out of it,
right.
that everyone else that she knew seemed to be partnered, and that to have a home base with a significant other just made all the branching out and trying different things with different people easier because there was someone to report home to, you know?
Yeah.
I was in an open relationship for 9 years, and we were really good about communication. We would talk before and after we were with some. We never did something together.
Hmm.
Because unfortunately, I found myself being so attracted to Asian men, and he found himself so attracted to redheaded men that our taste didn't, you know, like it would have been perfect if we could have found another couple that was an Asian guy and a redhead.
Right, you know? Right. No, that's so funny. In 9 years of being in an open relationship, you never did, like, play together.
We always played separately. We either had sex as the two of us or off with other people and then report back to each other. And we were very good about the communication, and I sometimes say spoiled me, you know, because after 9 years of an open relationship, I simply didn't feel, it felt like such a natural fit to me that, I mean, I've never had a monogamous relationship, because that was really my first and only long-term relationship.
Mm.
So I would love to find a partner who, a significant other, you know, that's kind of my dream right now. And I would hope that it would be someone who was game to try new things on a fairly regular basis, because I think that too many couples kind of lose the spark with things because they're doing the same things all the time.
Right.
And, you know, some of these experiments that you can, some of, like, for example, I think I mentioned it earlier, the first time I found myself, you know, blindfolded and tied up and submitting to someone was such a revelation for me. And it was, I was 41 years old and I had never done anything like that before. And I was just like, oh, this is really, really working for me on some primal level, you know?
Yeah, 50 million Elvis fans can't be wrong.
Yeah, exactly, right? Exactly. Or like water sports, you know, like having someone pee in my mouth for the first time was just like, oh!
You're like, I've been giving it away for free all these years.
Just, yeah, I mean.
Yeah, and something like that that's just so ordinary every day all of a sudden becomes so charged.
Yeah, and like, it just hadn't even occurred.
for some reason, it hadn't occurred to me before that I could do that, you know, until this guy was like, hey, I want to piss in your mouth, and I'm super into him, so I'm like, yeah, you can do whatever the hell you want, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
So yeah, moments like those are so exciting that I would love to find a partner who is into that, who is into exploring that way. You know what I worry about? I spend so much time... I have so many hang-ups. Like, I've started... I went to Kink Aware Professionals. If you don't know about it, you can Google. It's a place to find a therapist or a psychiatrist or even, like, a yoga instructor or whatever who is, like, kink-friendly.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It's a great resource.
So I found myself a therapist, and he's... It's the first time I've had a therapist who's also a gay man as well, you know? So he doesn't pathologize any of my fetishes at all. He's always like, well, you should stop worrying about that being perverted or whatever, because it's just fine. It's just your worry that is the issue.
Oh, hallelujah.
Yeah. But that does, but when someone says that to you...
That guy needs to teach a seminar to some of the professionals I've seen. My God. Do you ever get that... Did you ever have a therapist who you're, like, trying to tell them about your fucking life and you can see the, like, dollar signs in their eyes because they're like, oh, I'm going to write my book and I'm going to, like, make my millions off of this person because I've never talked to a sex worker before. I've never talked to a gay person who's gay in this way before. I've never talked to a polyamorous person before. And it's just like...
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, God. You should be paying me.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like, yeah. No, you know, the thing about therapists is there are so many... It's kind of like finding a relationship.
Totally.
It's like, you know, there's so many different kinds and you got to be careful. Yeah, I had the one that I mentioned before that also said, you know, entering a sex club is like entering hell. Also, like, toward the end, she started falling asleep on me. And then once I woke her up and she said, well, clearly whatever you were doing was, you know, the defense mechanisms of yours were boring me, I guess. So she was blaming me for falling asleep
on
me. Oh,
man, did they teach that one and... In, like, shrink school, they're like, listen, if you get bored, just use this line. But it sounds like you then found, or have found, somebody who is not an asshole like that.
I have found someone who's really, really supportive and who is just trying to get me to get over some... Like, for example, I have a couple of... fetishes that are a little bit bizarre or taboo or off the beaten track. But his whole thing is, you've just got to relax about all that and be present to people. And, you know, I think I got very stuck on this whole idea for a long time that you have to find a perfect match, that you have to be like, that someone has to be the exact same species as you.
Right.
But I think, in fact, a lot of people, a lot of kinksters probably come to, or just a lot of people, probably come together where one person has a fetish or a preference or whatever that doesn't quite match with another's, yeah. And they just find a way to deal, yeah. You know? Like, for example, my husband and I, Ariel... We knew that I was the much, much, much more sexually driven guy. Mm. We knew that in our open, even though he was the one that said, let's have an open relationship, because he had just taken a bunch of feminism classes.
Yes! Awesome. That's what, you know, you're welcome. Single best thing. I'm always saying feminism has, if we've done nothing else, it's to spread... The idea and the encouragement for people to
right.
ask their spouse for an open relationship.
That's exactly what happened within, like, the first few weeks. We were like, because we got very serious very soon. We were just one of those things where it's like, oh my gosh, I like you. And so somewhere in the first month, I would say, he said, it seems like we're getting pretty serious into a relationship. And if we are, I think we should discuss... on a regular basis, it being an open one, you know, like keep checking in. You know, maybe we'll change our mind at some point, but let's keep checking in on a regular basis about
it. Sounds very wise.
Yeah. What actually did end up happening was that for about the first year, maybe a year and a couple months, we didn't have sex with anybody else.
Yeah.
Then we started to, and yes, indeed, we were regularly checking in about it. When we finally broke up, it was because we had kind of become more like friends than like lovers. And also, our lives, unfortunately, the next time I'm in a relationship, I have to like remember, it's incredibly important to like be friends with a lot of your partner's friends too, you know. We had totally separate groups of friends.
Yeah.
And
it's good to have both. It's good to have your own people that you're like, go do your stuff that you guys like to do, like lacrosse or horror movies or like whatever.
Right.
And then also be able to get along with each other's people and have mutual friends. You know, I feel like that balance is very important.
For sure. Because our lives kept, our life and our careers, our friendships, our careers, everything just started being so separate that we just grew apart. But anyway, after the relationship, I was like, I want that again. I think, you know, all relationships go through some lots of kind of negotiation and feeling things out, and
it's a good way to build trust.
Yeah.
To show each other that you're willing to do something that you may not have had an instinct for, but that you're excited to explore it.
Yeah.
Because you care about somebody.
I think my feeling is this. My theory is that if both partners are kind of, you know how Dan Savage uses the GGG.
Right.
If both partners are kind of game to experiment early on, like, hey, why don't we try that? You know, just be a little bit creative in the same way that you want to be a little bit creative in where you're choosing to go on dates. You know what I mean? Hey, let's see jazz tonight. Or how about we, you know, go on a hike through whatever.
Also, that initial, you know, the like honeymoon period or whatever is when you're both super hot for each other. So that would be a good time to be,
to be like,
I like this, you know?
Yeah. Another thing is that being the host of Risk and being Mr. Come Out about this, that, and the other.
Right.
I do tend to lay out all my cards on the table right from the beginning. And that's okay, but I think you have to be very, you still have to be careful about it. You know, you can't let laying out all your cards and saying, look, I am definitely a polyamorous kind of person and I'm definitely into yada, yada, yada. You can't let that turn someone off from you.
Right.
You have to, like, let there be room, you know. I think that when push comes to shove, I'll bet most people do wait a little bit before revealing some of their weirder kinks, you know?
You know, it's so interesting what you're saying, because I really relate to you as somebody who feels most comfortable just wearing my heart on my sleeve
and
putting my cards on the table to mix metaphors and just being like, hey, this is who I am and you should know, and if you don't like it, there's the door. And I've always kind of been that way, and it's served me really well in a lot of ways. But I'm trying to be aware of the fact that you can allow, as you were just saying, like, you can allow things to breathe.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be that you're playing hard to get, which is the thing that I've always really hated and wanted to avoid, or that you're being coy.
Right.
Like, that that you can, like, enjoy some of the, like, seduction or the mystery of it. And that can be an okay thing to play with.
Yeah, I think that part of what it is I think you're absolutely right. Like, I've always, you know, like, it gets me nervous to hear the whole idea of, oh, you want to be mysterious, et cetera, et cetera. Because, yeah, I'm like, I'm not a good first date. I'm one of those people who would rather have sex first and then talk. That's exactly what I was talking about before. That's why I loved, you know, to have sex with someone and then start, then be like, hey, you want to get dinner? You know what I mean? Because for some reason, for me, that feels so, like, freeing of, because when I feel like when you go on dates, there's a tendency to feel like, oh, we're on an audition.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But regardless, whether you have sex first or later, in the early stages of getting to know someone, maybe it's best not to think of it as deliberately being mysterious or hiding some things.
Or withholding, yeah.
Right, but letting a person get to know bits of you, you know, because if a person knows, you know, like for example, if I were to sit down on a first date with someone and be like, well, you've got to love pissing in my mouth because that
I'm thirsty.
Right. I mean, that doesn't leave the person a lot of breathing space for getting to know, you know, that might turn them off from just getting to know other interesting things about me.
And I am, what I'm realizing from you saying that is that I almost feel like if somebody said it to me in that way, I would feel like they didn't really want me. They weren't like, hot for me to piss in their mouth. They were like, well, this is the thing that I need, and I need like you to do it for me instead of I want you to do this and I'm attracted to you. And I think that maybe also that goes back to the thing about your type, right? Like maybe some folks would feel like they don't want to be like desirable, like just for being young, or just for being a certain race, or even just for having like certain kink, like compatibilities, right? Like we want to be like loved and desired for the individual people that we are, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that in my case, like a lot of the reasons that I'm hung up over some of these preferences of mine is because, like, I think I'm a little bit over 90 days into no alcohol, no pot, and no poppers. Poppers were another thing that I was huge into.
Mazel tov. That's really amazing.
And I think that in this sober period now, I'm able to look at myself a little bit more clearly and to see that some of being so hung up on all those, here's what I am, here's my type, here's what, you know, I'm worried I'll never find my guy because he's got to be this, that, and the other, was actually out of fear of allowing myself to be a changing person and meet someone else face to face and allow them to be a changing person.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you, I'm realizing maybe that some people listening don't know what poppers are. Can you explain what poppers are?
Poppers are, in some cases, they're amyl nitrates, and in some cases, they're amyl nitrites. And in some cases, they're neither of those things. They're just pretending to be those things.
Like, what is it, VHS cleaner?
It's a chemical, it's a liquid chemical that when you sniff it, gives you this warm rush of basically like horniness for, oh, I don't know, about a minute.
Yeah.
And
just enough time to get it in.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. A lot of people think that poppers are all about relaxing the sphincter, right? Because
They have that notoriety.
You're right.
Like, I've worked in like sex shops before where people are like, oh, where do you keep your poppers? And of course, because they're feminist sex toys stores, we're like, actually, like, let me educate you about anal sex and let me show you the lubes and how you should like relax and go slowly and maybe you don't want to like lose your mind before you start. Anyway, so that's their reputation.
Yes. Yeah.
But you're saying it's not so much about physical relaxation and more about like losing your inhibitions.
Well, not losing inhibitions. It's that there is really kind of like, in the same way that when you take a shot of vodka or you like have a hit of off a whippet or something like that.
Right.
It has an instant like, whoa, I'm kind of blown away with how into you I am right now. Mm. It's kind of this warm and fuzzy, animalistic, horny feeling. So Yes, guys, if you go to a gay cruise area or a gay sex party or something like that, guys are sniffing poppers who are not engaging in anal sex. They're just doing it because it's a turn on. And for me, it became just so, it just became habitual. And it becomes really kind of like embarrassing when you're in bed, for example, and you're like, where are the poppers? Where are the poppers? Where are the poppers? Every 5 minutes, because right. they've gotten lost in the covers.
Right.
It just begins to be like really apparent that you're psychologically addicted to this shit.
Right.
It's not helping you stay present to right. the person you're with. You know, like my therapist would say, it's almost as if you're having sex a little bit more with the pot and the poppers and the alcohol
right.
than with the person that you're with.
I've had that experience. I had one client, alcohol client, who he was a doctor, clearly from his apartment, very wealthy doctor, and he got into that state where ordinarily I would be like, not allow that or any more than like a glass of wine in a session, mm-hmm. but he was hosting and I was kind of like, all right, dude, like, you know, but he did get into, it's what I always think about when I think about poppers, was this person who, in order to allow himself to submit and to do the things that we were doing, he just, you know, it's one thing to be like, I'm gonna like take this shot or I'm gonna like smoke this joint or whatever, but he would just start to panic as he would start to come down, and even when we would be like in the middle of a scene, and he would be like, where are they, where are they, where are they?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And I, after a while, I was like, you're actually like, I'm not playing at feeling disgusted by you right now. I'm like actually disgusted by you. And that's a limit for me, because like, that's not what I'm not being hired to actually be disgusted.
Yeah.
By you. That's my own like sort of code. It's like, we can play at that because we're grown-ups. And as somebody who is actually kinky, like yeah. I love getting people to that state, you yeah. know, I love getting to that state myself, either as a top or as a bottom, but like if somebody, again, it's like they don't even care that it's me. I might as well be a robot.
Right, right.
And, you know, I look forward to the time when that guy can afford a robot to do that for him.
Right.
Because, you know, that's like a few years down the line, probably.
Yeah,
and that'll be good, because it's a waste of my time, is how I felt.
It's too clearly a crutch.
Yeah.
I had some guys criticize me about it, too, saying, you rely on enhancement too much, is the way a guy put it, you
yeah.
know, and I knew what he meant, yeah.
Yeah.
That allowing things to evolve naturally
yeah.
is hindered when you're grabbing for some substance every few minutes.
And the thing that actually really struck me when you were describing the, I have not done poppers very much in my life, or nitrous, like whippets, very much either, but I do know the feeling, and hearing you describe it just kind of made me think about the fact that is like my goal from, so that's what I would like to get out of sex, that feeling anyway, or kink, or like a kink scene.
Right.
Would like to feel that like animalistic, like primal rush, and that like glowing warm feeling. And
oh, absolutely.
And it's almost like you can't, again, I'm not a teetotaler, and I totally think that if people like can lubricate in moderation to get in the mood, that's something that I endorse and that I enjoy. But if you can't trust that you can get there with your own consciousness and your own body and your own intimacy and interaction with that person.
Oh, absolutely.
Then that's, I mean, I'm not going to be like critical or judgmental, like you were saying, that guy was like, oh, well, it seems like you need a lot of enhancements. Like, you know, we have to be sensitive to one another. Nobody's perfect, but it does seem like the point is to maybe try to find a more sustainable way to get it, and luckily sex can be that.
Oh yeah. Oh, I absolutely, yeah. And that's another reason that I think it's so important to if not find a significant other, but to play with partners
yeah.
who are willing to try things, like try new things or experiment, because the two of you might not even know how trying a certain thing might get you into a headspace that's, you know, much better than, say, the experience of, like, 60 seconds of feeling stoned on poppers.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, I did want to ask you, you had so many amazing New York stories. I wonder if you have had experiences. I feel like New York is such a notorious cruising zone for many reasons, but have you had experiences cruising in other places where you had, like, culture shock?
Oh, you know, it's interesting. I have not done so much. I mean, I went to Amsterdam and had a lot of fun over there. Now, this was in the age of Grindr.
Right.
You know, where...
Which has totally changed.
Yeah, where you can literally just like... And in San Francisco once, I was in some sort of forest in the bright, broad daylight. I was on LSD.
Maybe Golden Gate Park?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. That would definitely be it. Because
That would also be a place that you would be on LSD.
That's where we got... Golden Gate Park is where we got the LSD. And I think the first place we ended up was in these... It kind of felt like Alice in Wonderland. Of these little, like, lanes of bushes and stuff like that with people popping in and out. And I think that it was a little bit just in that early LSD is starting to hit state. I think that me and my friends were all like, we should be somewhere that's not so, you know, mysterious right now.
Right. Did you watch the show Looking that was on HBO?
No, I've never seen it.
I mean, we could have a pop culture critique of that show, but I gotta tell you, because you know it's about gay men in San Francisco, the very first scene of the pilot, which is the only episode I watched because I was so bored by the end, I was like, this is not a story I care about, like these like affluent white guys in San Francisco, I'm like,
right.
Snore. But the first scene, which encapsulated I think my whole issue with the show, is the protagonist is cruising in like the part of the woods of Golden Gate Park that's like notorious for cruising, and he, like, this guy, they, you know, they do the eyeing each other thing, and then looking at the crotch and looking back up at the eyes, and then they start kind of like approaching each other, and he's like, wait, can I, what's your name, like, and like kind of tries to like all of a sudden act like he's on a date with him, and the guy's like, what's your problem, man? And just walks away. And the guy's like, man, cruising sucks, basically, is like his attitude. And I was like, is this what this show is going to be? Like, that this is what it's like for gay men now? They, like, don't even have a sense of their, like, cultural history of cruising that they...
It is really interesting. I mean, you know... Exactly what you just said. Like, all the advertisements I saw of the show, it looked like everyone was white, which I'm like, that's not San Francisco. No. And also, yes, who cares if everyone's, you know, affluent, you know? I mean, or everyone's, like, gorgeous or whatever. You know what? Like, it would be interesting to see a show about real people.
Yeah.
But anyway, yes, I think that you're very true. You're very right that... A lot of, because I'm so attracted to younger guys.
Yeah.
Did
that start happening at like a certain
point? Well, you know, it's interesting because it's kind of like I was attracted to guys my own age all throughout my childhood. And then...
You got older and they just stayed the same.
Yeah, exactly. Like once I hit my 20s, it's just, well, thank God I did not remain attracted to guys under, you
right,
know,
Humbert style.
But yeah, at a certain point, like in my 20s, I just continued being attracted to guys who were like in their early 20s, and honestly, I would, that's another one of the thing about some of my preferences is, if I had a switch and I could say, okay, I'm done with that preference, I would get rid of it because it's not convenient.
Right.
You know, I mean, it is, there is truth to the whole idea that age is just a number. I mean, there are some young guys who are incredibly mature, and there are some older guys who are incredibly immature. But, you know, by the numbers, there's usually big differences in people according to ages. And, yeah I do feel a little bit like younger guys, younger gay guys nowadays, don't know so much about, like, you know, I don't know, the history of BDSM and leather, cruising, the history of, like, AIDS and how
the fight against it. All of our elders died.
Yeah.
I mean, we're having, like, a cultural crisis right now because of that. But, I mean, I think a lot of people are aware of that and are really working hard to figure out how to make sure that we're creating that history. But I do think that a lot of really young people, this is my old queen mode, like, a lot of young people do take it for granted.
Yeah.
You know, and interestingly, like, some of the guys that I work with, who are really young, you know, they use Grindr, and, like, I think using Grindr is great, but also, like, it's amazing to me to think that you would have always had Grindr since you were a teenager.
Right, right.
And, like, to not have a sense of the ability to do that dance that you've been describing,
that
intuition, you know, because it seems to me that in my experiences with, like, flirting and cruising, which are obviously, like, culturally different being a woman, but, you know, I've been in a lot of queer spaces that are similar to what you're describing, maybe not, like, Central Park in the middle of the night, but more like the parties. And, I feel like, yes, what the internet can do to connect us is amazing, but so much of, like, the physical and psychological reaction I have is that intuitive moment, or like you were even saying, like, animalistic moment, and that you don't get that when you use a computer.
It's true. I am a writer, so I love texting.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I like that social anxiety that I always felt at the bars, I don't feel as much when I approach someone over Grindr and everything, but I'm very keenly aware of the language that has arisen on... You know, thank God we got rid of people saying no fats, femmes, or Asians.
Did we get rid of that?
Well, I think for the most part, I see it a lot more rarely now than years ago.
I mean, it's become no fats, no femmes, no Asians has become, like, its own, like, joke. I mean, joke about, like, a crisis.
Right, right.
That's, like, a very common thing that people would say on Grindr.
There are guys who will on Grindr say the whole top bottom thing, like, it doesn't leave room for, and so I think a lot of young guys, you know, in their teens picking up Grindr are learning about gay culture only from the way that these things are working. You know, I'm a total top, I'm a total bottom. A lot of I have to explain to a lot of guys, oh, you know, there's all kinds of in-between space, you know.
It's kind of being versatile.
Yeah, and it's not... And also, just this whole idea of, like, there's more to being sexual than a penis into an orifice. Like, there are other things that can turn you on or be fun or even help you to achieve an orgasm, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to think that people would be getting all of that cultural knowledge from a space where, because you're behind this digital wall of anonymity, you feel free to sort of say maybe the, like, baser things. I'm not even talking about being politically incorrect. I'm talking about, like, you know, saying really hateful things that you might not say in a bar. That you're, like, socialized, like, not to be a racist asshole in a bar, but you're like, oh, well, I can be a racist asshole, like, on this app.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, especially because I date so many Asian guys, like, I've seen people say horribly hateful things where I'm it's sure. just like, wow, what on earth? Yeah, and what's so funny about it is it's often the person who first approaches. And then, you know, not so much interest is shown, and then all of a sudden just a tirade of racism comes out.
God.
But no, but yeah.
But it's what you're saying about texting is really interesting.
Yeah, like my first, there's a story that I tell on Risk. It's called Beyond Kink Camp Part 1. Is the first really amazing BDSM experience I had. I met a guy on FetLife. And the two of us were texting and being on the phone with each other for about 5 weeks before we met face-to-face. And when we finally met face-to-face, that was when he tied me up and I submitted to him and everything. But the texting and the phone calls we had done were so creative and so imaginative, and just we were having great, very interesting get-to-know-you conversation. And I think that that's way too rare. People don't use these communication tools to actually communicate. And yeah, I mean, honestly, like when I sobered up, I took most of those apps off my phone because it's very hard not to adapt to what the mainstream is doing and just to be like, oh, if it, like the thing that bewilders me the most is, you start a conversation where this person seems interested, you seem interested, then you just ask a question like, oh, I don't know, like, what part of town do you live in? And that's the end of the conversation. Like,
right.
And you know it's simply because this tool is so distracting that I guess someone more attractive came along. You know, you thought you had a nice little conversation going, there's no goodbye, it's just gone.
Yeah. Well, I wrote a book about sexting etiquette that's coming out next year. So hopefully that book will change all of that. People will feel wrapped on the wrist by me, and then they'll start to be kinder.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I'm trying to walk it back and remember what we were talking about when we started talking about it. Oh, I was asking if you have had like cultural differences in like cruising in other places. You were talking about Amsterdam.
Oh, there I ended up going to a club that was another one of these like saunas, you know?
Yeah, where, like a bathhouse.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was fun. It was definitely fun. I was amazed by how gigantic it was.
Yeah.
There were several floors, all kinds of different rooms. It was like a wonderland. Yeah. So, yeah, that was fun. The truth is I haven't done a ton of cruising outside of New York City.
It's interesting.
I mean, since I've become a touring, I take Risk out on the road all the time, I have met a lot of guys through the apps, through Grindr. What a lot of people don't know, speaking of history, Recon, which is the gay app for kinky guys,
right,
is the first of all of those apps. It precedes Grindr. And it's kind of fascinating to see, for me to watch how Recon goes through phases where some of what are the taboos in BDSM are able to be spoken of or not able to be spoken of, or you know, those spaces in BDSM where like dominant energy people like are kind of asshole-ish and feel free to be that way.
I've heard of this phenomenon. Yes. Yes. It's like, okay, we're not done negotiating yet, so you're not my master.
Yeah, yeah.
Until we press go.
I've said this so many times that I wish Recon would add a discussion board.
Interesting.
Like a place where the community can talk. Not just like FetLife, and now I guess a couple other places. I think some people are a little fed up with FetLife at this point because of whatever bullying and that kind of thing.
It's inevitable. On. Yeah.
Yeah, but no, I wish that the gay male community, like, I think Recon would be the perfect place to like, add that, you know, hey, we're all meeting at such and such a bar, you know, who's interested in this fetish? Let's talk about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Instead of just all hooking up.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I've tried to do that my own, actually. I've put together parties in Chelsea for not sex parties, but social party, like munches.
Right.
For guys who are into like water sports.
Cool.
One that really was kind of a failure because not enough people showed up, but for guys who were interested in hypno play.
How fun.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think that hypno play is a little too abstract.
Right.
Like, yeah.
I know some people who are into it. I've heard of it a lot as a Wonder Woman based fetish, apparently. Which helped me to understand it.
Oh, I get you. Yeah. Or like Batman was sometimes. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, it's like an interrogation. It makes complete sense to me. You're like actually not in control of yourself. I mean,
right.
It's like it's pure psychological bondage. I mean, makes sense to me. Anyway, that's a different podcast, I guess. But would you say, so in conclusion, would you say that after all of your experiences cruising and how you kind of like came into your adult sexuality and you're like actually like starting to like explore your gay identity and like learning about gay culture like through cruising, now you have like different needs and different desires and have had different experiences, do you feel like cruising is still something that like has promise for you in terms of what you want, or are you more interested in the going back to what we were saying before, like the conversation, the like let's fuck and then give me your number and like let's go get dinner?
I think that I'm hopelessly optimistic. You know, I think that I'm a person who, yes, might be, you know, for example, might be disappointed in Grindr, but will probably never get rid of it in time. You know, it's off the phone, but it's still somewhere on my computer.
Sure.
Or might be, you know, a little bit fed up with dating younger guys, but will probably, you know, date a younger guy sometime in the future anyway. So I think that as far as cruising goes as like a method of maybe meeting people and eventually ending up in a conversation, I know it's happened. I know I've done it before, you know? And so, yeah, I think that at 45, now that I'm sobering up and trying to, you know, kind of work on myself a little bit, I think that all of the things I've tried before sexually and all the things that I'm curious to try in the future sexually, I'm hoping that I can bring those to the table with people in a sort of a more relaxed way, a way that doesn't require a lot of crutches or drugs and enhancements. And kind of like, you know what I think that I'm finding out is that it really, and it sounds so cheesy to say, but it's first and foremost about kind of loving and having compassion for and taking care of yourself, being okay with who you are, and being so okay with who you are that you have the magnanimity and the generosity to give someone else the space to be who they are and explore together. So that's what I guess I'm hoping for. I guess I'm hoping to, some of the things that have become fixations, obsessions, crutches, to leave them behind, some of the masks that I put on, to start to peel them off a little bit and see in this second half of my life what I still want to bring along with me and what I might want to explore as completely new ground. And I think it's all going to really hinge on how comfortable I can become with myself. You know, I think this entire summer, what I've been focused on is, let's not worry about dating or even hooking up so much this summer. Let's just get healthy and start to feel better about oneself, look at myself. And I think that you put your finger on it. I think that I've got to stop feeling like I know exactly what I want.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what I don't know.
Ain't that the truth? Well, it sounds like you're in an amazing place.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. I wish you luck, but I think you're on the right track. You have my stamp.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on my podcast. Oh, it's been really cool to like get to know you by talking to you on the podcast.
Oh yeah, this is a total joy.
Cool. Okay, great. Well, so we talked to what's your Twitter handle? Is it at Kevin Allison?
Oh, it's at the Kevin Allison.
The Kevin Allison. And at Risk Podcast?
At Risk Show.
Risk Show, cool. Yeah. Great. Fantastic. Well, I'm a fan, and if the listeners are not already, I'm sure they will be soon.
Awesome.
Cool. Okay. And this is usually where I would press stop, but it's over. Oh, yeah.
Thank you for tuning in to episode 29. Follow at Tina Horn's Ass and at Into That Podcast on Twitter. Subscribe and write us a review if you are so inclined on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite place to listen to podcasts. And visit wiredpeopleintothat.com to subscribe to our newsletter and listen to our entire archive. Next month, my guest will be Cooper Beckett, author of My Life on the Swing Set.
I do think that it's like Pandora's box. When you explore non-monogamy, mm-hmm. you will fundamentally be changed.
Hmm.
Either being on board
yeah.
or not.
Right, and depending on your experience, probably yeah. too.
And you are unlikely to vacillate between those two.
Interesting.
And, I will never
really
be
funny.
Able to be monogamous again.
Right.
Because I've seen the other side of the curtain.
Right.
And for some people, and I try to make sure that I don't downplay monogamy, because for some people, for most people, monogamy is exactly what they need and exactly what they want, and they will be happy like that. And that's amazing and good for them.
Yeah.
And I'm on board with that. What I have a problem with is the people who pretend to be monogamous or think they're monogamous and go through life with loathing
right.
and with and cheating. Most cheating comes with self-loathing, whether you want to admit it or not.
Totally.
And just because you've never had a conversation, or just because you've never even known that it was an option. Like, I wouldn't have known swinging was an option unless my friend had randomly said something.
As ever, Why Are People Into That is produced and hosted by Tina Horn, yours truly. Our theme song is by Pine from Oakland, California. Our website was designed by Justin Levesque, and we are exclusively sponsored by Smitten Kitten, who you can visit at smittenkittenonline.com and get 20% off your order when you enter the code Y. That's W-H-Y. Until next time, I'll be... Wait, what did you say your name was again?
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.